listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations all across America, Europe, and Africa, American Forces Radio on every U.S. military base in the world, simulcast as television via the Free Speech TV Network, on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide. More people watch or listen to the Tom Hartman Program in more stations and outlets than any other progressive talk show in the world. And just, we've added four new stations now in the last 2 weeks. But a special shout out, our most recent edition, in fact, Saturday, I was in L.A. at the L.A. Press Club doing a gig for this, to roll this out. KPFK, the legendary Pacifica station, the largest FM signal in the United States, in the city of Los Angeles, 90.7 FM, now carrying our show. And so we're so pleased to have you all with us, thank you. Senator Bernie Sanders is with us. It's Friday. It's time for Brunch with Bernie. And Bernie, I understand you're hunkered down in Vermont as the snow is approaching.
It's beautiful. It's troubling, though. We have a senior meeting to talk about protecting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid tomorrow. I think our attendance is going to be cut a little bit, but we'll have the meeting anyhow. But it's beautiful, and that's the way it is.
Yeah, and I should say to our watchers on Free Speech TV, our people who are watching on TV, that we don't have a live video feed of you today because you're coming in from home because, you know, Right. Basically the Northeast is shut down. There's a lot on the table, deficit reduction. You proposed a new legislation, you and Jan Schakowsky, where it's in our news story, the global warming influence on this storm, the chain CPI, there's just all kinds of, the post office.
There's all kinds of stuff that's going on. So let's start off with, I know, an issue that concerns a whole lot of people, and that is this deficit reduction debate.
Yeah.
Here is the first and most important point that everybody has got to understand, and that is, despite the ramblings of our Republican friends who talk about the only way that we can do deficit reduction is by cutting Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, education, environmental protection, and everything that working families need, and that's what the Paul Ryan budget and other budgets are about. Here is the important point. Today, revenue as a percentage of GDP is about 15.8%. That is almost the lowest revenue that we've had as a percentage of GDP in 60 years.
Wow.
Under Bill Clinton, when Clinton left office, we were running a significant surplus, over $200 billion. At that point, revenue as a percentage of GDP was over 20%.
Revenue being income to the government, mostly from taxes.
Right, that's right. Revenue coming into the government as a percentage of all economic activity in the country, gross domestic product. So the main point to be made is when you hear Republicans say, we got to cut, no more revenue, no more taxes on the wealthier large corporations, they are simply trying to misinform the American people. Revenue is exactly the major problem that we have right now. So then the next question is, okay, how do you get that revenue? And we have just introduced, I in the Senate, Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, in the House, legislation which addresses a huge, huge issue. Tom, you have heard me on the show speaking for many, many years now about the absurdity of large corporations stashing their money in the Cayman Islands or Bermuda or other tax havens. So these companies make huge profits. In fact, right now, corporate America is enjoying record-breaking profits. And then what they do is they start up these phony subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands, and they stash their money there, and they pay zero in taxes. The result of all of that is today, at 1.2%, corporate revenue as a percentage of GDP is lower in the United States than any other major country in the OECD, that's the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. That's all the major countries in the world. And what ends up happening is that today, corporations are paying just 12% of their profits in taxes. That's the lowest since 1972. So I think any sensible person, any fair-minded person would say, we have got to end these absurd tax breaks. Give you an example. There is a building in the Cayman Islands, five-story building that, quote-unquote, houses 18,000 corporations. Got that? One building, 18,000 corporations. Everybody understands what's going on. These are just post office boxes for large corporations in order for them to declare residency in the Cayman Islands where the tax rate is zero. We've got to put an end to that, and that's what this legislation does. If our legislation were signed by the president, it would bring in something like $590 billion over a 10-year period. That's a lot of money. The other thing that it does is it tells corporations who shut down in America and start manufacturing in low-wage countries abroad that they're still going to have to pay taxes to the United States of America. You know, I was reminded by a staffer this morning, Tom, that in 2008, all of these big banks and corporations, Bank of America and all these other guys, they went begging to the American people to get their welfare checks, their handouts, after their greed and illegal behavior and recklessness almost brought the financial system to its knees. You remember that?
Mm-hmm.
They were American companies, proud to be American, and just needed a little bit of help from the taxpayers of America. Right. 2 years later, in 2010, our friends at Bank of America established several hundred subsidiaries in the Cayman Islands in order to avoid paying taxes to the United States of America. So one day they're great American companies needing a handout from taxpayers. The next day they're foreign companies not wanting to pay taxes in this country, not wanting to help us deal with deficit reduction.
It's incredible.
And just a couple of weeks ago, I think I mentioned this the last time I was on the show, the Business Roundtable, which is a group of CEOs of the largest corporations in America, they propose that we raise the Medicare eligibility age to 70 years of age. They propose we raise the Social Security retirement age to 70. So these guys who are busy putting their money, their profits into the Cayman Islands in order to avoid paying taxes in America, lowering the amount of revenue our country needs, then they get up and say, oh, we don't have enough revenue. Let's cut Social Security. Let's cut Medicare. Let's cut Medicaid. Let's cut veterans programs.
Yeah.
I think that is grotesque. I mean, it's really a moral outrage, and it's something we have to address. And Congresswoman Schakowsky and I think, have taken a good step forward on that issue.
I wish you the very best with it.
The other area that I want to alert people about, again, dealing with deficit reduction, is everybody should remember the goal of all of the talk in Washington is $4 trillion in deficit in reducing the debt over a 10-year period. The good news is that the deficit, which had previously been a little bit over $1 trillion, is now down to $800 billion. That's good news. So we're making some progress on deficit reduction. What people should be aware of, however, is that most of that deficit reduction, significant part of it, had to do with cuts in programs that working families and lower-income people desperately need. So the challenge right now as we continue on the path of deficit reduction is to bring in a substantial amount of revenue. Eliminating these outrageous loopholes for tax havens is one way to do it.
It's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders on the line. He'll be taking your calls next here on the Tom Hartman program, 15 minutes past the hour. Be sure to check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov. He's got a great newsletter there. It's a great news and information aggregation site. You can sign his petition for a constitutional amendment or a Citizens United. There's a whole bunch of stuff there.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, of course, you can drop by TomHartman.com as well. And we've got a bunch of good, free, cool stuff there, too. We'll be right back. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour to our special edition. What is it? Snowball Fights with Bernie? Cocoa with Bernie? Soup with Bernie? Blizzard with Bernie? Snow Day with Bernie? Our Brunch with Bernie. Our Senator Sanders on the line with us taking calls from Vermont. And Bernie, Bob in Bradenton, Florida on the line for you.
Yes, Senator Sanders, it's an honor. Today we have tens of millions of people that are on or underemployed, and yet we have record corporate profits. What actions can we take to put worker wages back in line with corporate profits?
Bob, thanks very much for that excellent, excellent question. And I would say, Tom, one of the things that disturbs me very much in terms of both Congress and the media is the degree to which we are not talking about the collapsing middle class. The fact, as Bob indicated, we have not only millions of people unemployed. Real unemployment in America is not 7.8%. Let's never forget, there are a lot of people who are working 20 hours because they can't work 40 hours. We can't find those full-time jobs. And there are a lot of people who have given up looking for work and are not counted in the unemployment statistics. And then, as Bob indicates, you got millions more people who are working at Walmart's, McDonald's, and other low-wage jobs, and they're working 40, 50 hours a week, and they are not earning enough money to take care of themselves or their families. Often they're working without any health care benefits. They're working without any paid leave, sick leave, and they're really being exploited. That is the issue. The issue is, how do we grow the middle class, especially at a time when the wealthiest people are doing phenomenally well and large corporations are enjoying record-breaking profits? So, Bob, let me just tell you a couple of things that I think we should be doing. Number one, and Tom and I have discussed this many, many times, what economists will tell you is the fastest way to create millions of jobs and to make our country stronger and more productive is to invest heavily in rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure. That means roads, bridges, water systems, wastewater plants. Believe me, I fly a lot. We need major repairs in our major improvements in our airports, an air controlling system. Our rail system is falling further and further behind Europe, Japan, and even China. We need to invest in mass transportation. We need to invest in transforming our energy system away from fossil fuels like coal and oil. We need major wind projects. We need solar efforts. We need geothermal. We need biomass. We create jobs doing that as well. We need to be changing our trade policies, which encourages companies in many respects to shut down in America and move to China or other low-wage countries. So those are some of the ideas that we are working on to try to create the millions of jobs our people need.
Andy, in Lake Orion, Michigan, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, Bernie, Tom, thank you so much for all the work that you do on behalf of the middle class. I really appreciate it. I guess my main question is, I'm in the Carpenters Union here in Michigan, and we just saw a democracy being subverted right before our eyes here with our state house and right to work institution in our state. And I'd like to know, is what can we do? Because it seems like no one seems to be paying attention. It seems like the president himself doesn't pay attention. He reaches out to every other group of the Democratic Party except for unions. And I just wonder, what can we do, Bernie, in our state to bring attention to what's going on here and overturn this law?
Andy, thanks a lot for that very important question. And in case listeners may not be familiar with what Andy is talking about, the Republican legislature in Michigan recently voted to make Michigan a right to work for less, we call it, state, and made a real vicious attack against trade unionists in the state and people who are trying to have jobs that pay a living wage. I think, Andy, a couple of points I would make in response. As you probably know, that effort was funded by a lot of third-party groups, big-money groups, who, for obvious reasons, don't like unions, prefer to have people working for low wages, which talks then the need to repeal Citizens United and real campaign finance reform, so that reactionary big money interests, often billionaires out there, cannot buy elections and buy candidates who then bring forth terrible legislation like the Right to Work bill in Michigan.
Second of all, your point about the president and the Democrats not being stronger in defending unions is absolutely right. Unions, to my mind, should be right at the center of the Democratic coalition. The AFL, I just had a press conference with Rich Trumka the other day, and he mentioned, who's head of the AFL-CIO, and he mentioned you got 12 million members. We want more members. 12 million people is a whole lot of people. And come election time, many of those people are out knocking on doors, doing the right thing for progressive candidates. They need to be heard more, and they need to be defended more. So there are a number of pro-union things that we need to do, make it easier in terms of card check for workers to be able to form unions, make it easier so that union organizers do not get fired for their efforts, which often happens if they're working at a company. So, Andy, let me just say this. The unions today and historically have played the most important role, in my view, in protecting the American middle class. People don't know that, but the unions are responsible for many of the progressive gains that this country has seen in terms of wages, working conditions, healthcare programs, housing, etc. So hang in there. These are tough times, but some of us are more than aware, and I speak not just for myself, but many other people in the Senate and the House who are aware of the enormously important role Carpenters Union, your union, and others have played. And let's just keep going forward together.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Senator Sanders answering your questions in our national town hall meeting. We'll be back with more in just a second. Check out Bernie's website, sanders.senate.gov, and you'll find just a wealth of information as well as a really great newsletter there, the Bernie Buzz. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And one caller today is going to receive a free signed copy of Cracking the Code, my book on political communication, sent by Stamps.com. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Our national town hall meeting with a guy I think of as America's senator, although the good people of Vermont are proud that he is one of their two senators, Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, you're still here with us?
I am right here.
Okay. Amidst the snow there in Vermont. Paul in San Francisco, California. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, Senator Sanders. I'm calling about the H.R. 6407. The Postal Accountability Act that was passed in 2006. I guess most people don't know that this bill written by ALEC is what's responsible for the Postal Service having its financial woes. Would you or anyone else be able to sponsor a bill to simply repeal H.R. 6407 and give, you know, breathe some life back into the Postal Service?
Well, Paul, thanks very much for that question, and that is an issue that I have worked hard on and will continue to work very hard on. And what Paul says is absolutely correct, and a lot of people don't understand that. When the media talks about the financial problems facing the Postal Service, they forget that the major problem, and in fact, the problem responsible for 80% of the Postal Service's financial losses since 2007 is what Paul is talking about. And that is in 2006, George Bush insisted on a provision in the postal bill which mandated that the Postal Service pay out 75 years of future retiree health benefits in a 10-year period. That amounts to over $5 billion every single year. There is no other entity in the United States government that comes anywhere near close to that. No entity, to the best of my knowledge, in the private sector in America or in the world. So this is an incredibly onerous burden, which is the major cause of the financial crisis facing the Postal Service. Paul asked, would I introduce legislation? And the answer is, we did do that. We introduced sweeping postal reform legislation, which, among many other things, included language that would eliminate the need for the Postal Service to pay that $5 billion into that retirement fund. Right now, what we are working on, especially since the postmaster announced that he wanted to end Saturday mail delivery in August, we're going to be working very, very hard to put together a coalition in the Senate and in the House for real postal reform, which protects jobs, which gives the Postal Service the opportunity to earn more revenue in a variety of ways, and also, as Paul indicates, eliminate that onerous burden.
Kenneth, in Virginia Beach, Virginia, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, sir. Thank you for your hard work, Tom. I appreciate your voice on the air. And, Ms. Senator Sanders, I want to thank you for all of your hard work and your adherence to a creed of helping the people.
Thank you.
My main reason for calling was, what is being done about the highway situation? During the Bush administration, they raised the weight limit four times, and it now exceeds every engineering standard for highways built prior to 2006. Now, isn't that an unfunded mandate from the federal government that states have to improve those highways?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't it be a good idea to reduce that weight limit at least by 40,000 pounds until we catch up with the deterioration of our roads and bridges?
You make a very important point. And the point that the caller is making, and I remember this as a former mayor, is when you look at damage done to highways, and our highways, by and large, are in pretty bad shape throughout the country, one of the major causes are these very, very heavy trucks. And they do a lot of damage to bridges and to roads. So I would simply answer the call by saying you're absolutely right. We have to do one of two things, at least make sure that if these very, very heavy trucks continue being on roads where they really should not be, then those companies are going to have to pay for the cost of repairing those roads, or else we prevent those very, very heavy trucks from being on those roads in the first place. But most importantly, the point is that our roads, our bridges are in very, very bad shape. This is one of the contributing factors. We've got to address it.
Mo, in New York City, listening on WWRL. Mo, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Oh, Senator Sanders, what if you consider that perhaps the competition for the railroads, they're languishing because the competition, that is trucks, cars, buses, and airlines, are heavily subsidized by the government. If that weren't the case, perhaps the railroads would be competitive, and we could have high-speed rail and so on. And also the damage to the environment, which results from the spreading out of the population by the roads.
Well, all I can say is I believe for a dozen different reasons, including protecting our environment and combating global warming, we have got to move aggressively to improve and expand our rail system. As I mentioned earlier, compared to Europe, compared to Japan, and even China, our rail system is way, way behind in high-speed rail and in other areas. So I think it makes a hell of a lot of sense that we invest in our rail system. Under the Stimulus Act, we did do that. I know in the state of Vermont, we put $50 million to improve rail. That was going on all over the country. But we need a coordinated, aggressive effort to make rail a much more important part of our transportation system, both for cargo and for passengers. One of the areas, for example, that we can make some great improvements is getting people to the airports a lot faster than we do right now. So the answer is, Mo, we have got to invest heavily in rail. And by the way, when we do that, we create jobs as well.
Terry in SoCal, California. Is that right, Terry?
That's fine. In Santa Cruz County on Monterey Bay, Tom.
Okay.
Again, highest compliments to you, Mr. Hartman, for a great program and a great addition to the national conversation we have. And to Senator Sanders, he belongs in the Senate, unlike so many of the Republicans who do not.
Thank you, Terry.
Are you hearing me?
Yes, thank you.
We're hearing you fine.
Understood.
Thank you very much.
Senator Sanders, I must tell you, I watch Harry Reid and his poor capacity to deliver an effective message, his weak voice, his weak body language, and his ineffectiveness at debate in the Senate floor. Please replace Reid as the majority leader. Do you agree with someone like Whiteside or Barbara Mikulski or Senator Klobuchar or yourself? That's my question. And I'm not alone.
Okay, thanks, Jerry. You know, the I don't agree, and I'll tell you why. Harry Reid has his strengths and Harry Reid has his weaknesses. And I think Harry would be the first person to tell you that he doesn't consider himself the world's most articulate guy. But on the other hand, what the most important quality that a majority leader has to have is he has to reflect and work with the people who are in the caucus. And he does that extraordinarily well. He has to balance my political views, and I'm probably the most progressive member of the caucus, with people who are extremely conservative. He has to somehow craft together a kind of coalition of folks who can go forward, which is a lot harder than you think. And he does that, in a sense, pretty well. So he should not be blamed. My own, tell you the truth, perception is Harry Reid is a lot more progressive in his views than many people think. But as the leader, he has got to reflect many, many other members of the caucus who may not be as progressive as he is. So it's a tough job. I think he does it well.
Joe in Lake Elsinore, California. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Senator Sanders, it's a pleasure to speak with you. I was listening to you earlier discussing some of the issues about the Postal Office's commitment with health care. And my question, I guess, should be, and Tom and I have spoke about this before, how can we use Obamacare to rectify this $5 billion annual contribution to what appears to be a health insurance plan and put that money directly into, as with a universal health care plan, a government option to help offset some of those expenditures, along with dealing with, let's say, workers' compensation and all the other health care funding issues that we have, but we're using the current model of the president's health care plan to try to reduce the exposure to some of the private and public enterprises.
Well, Joe, you raise an interesting point, and what you're touching on, I think, is the dysfunctionality in general of our healthcare system. Here is the post office putting, in my view, far too much money, no longer needs to do that, but money into retiree health system. All over America, small businesses are struggling with escalating costs of healthcare, and they're putting a lot of their profits that they'd like to reinvest in the business into healthcare. You got 50 million people who today do not have any health insurance. We hope that will change significantly when Obamacare becomes implemented. You got a lot of people out there who have insurance but have high deductibles and have high copayments. Our primary health care system, the ability of people to find a doctor when they need a doctor for primary care, is a disaster. Dental care is a disaster. So if you touch on the point that our whole system is dysfunctional. We are the only major country on earth without a national health care program. We spend twice as much per person on health care. The results are not good. I am a strong single payer health care advocate, and that would solve many of the health care problems that we have, including the postal services.
We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
It's Brunch with Bernie. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls at our national town hall meeting. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person? And we dare to say, no, not a chance, the Tom Hartman Program. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls in our national town hall meeting. And Frank in Garner, North Carolina, you are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Can you hear me?
Frank, hear you just fine.
Yeah, I'm right here. Yes, Senator, thank you for taking my call. One of the problems that I keep on running into, especially when I talk to my friends, I live in the North Carolina area, is I keep on running into the, well, they're just going to cut the waste out of things. But I really believe that the best way that the progressives can go about explaining that the GOP cutting the budget is nothing but, as you would say, a war on people, middle class, on the poor, is that they really have to articulate how they're going to cut, what they're going to cut, and not say, oh, we're going to cut out waste. No, you're going to tell us what you're going to do and how you're going to do it and who do you think it's going to hurt. And I think that would be the best way to get things, to get people to understand that the GOP does not have their best interests at heart.
Frank, that is a great point, and you're absolutely right. Pay attention to how some of us are going to be responding to the so-called Ryan budget. Paul Ryan, of course, was the Republican vice presidential nominee. And he is the chairman of the Budget Committee in the House. He's going to be bringing forth a budget. And without having seen the budget yet, I can pretty well tell you what it's going to be. It's going to be massive cuts in Medicare, in Medicaid, in student loans, in education in general, in infrastructure. You name the program that helps working people, and they're going to cut it. And Frank is absolutely right. There are many people who think, well, they're just cutting waste. They're not cutting waste. They're going to make it harder for seniors to get decent health care. They're going to make it harder for children and lower-income people to get health care. They're going to make it harder, even harder than it is today, for working families to be able to afford education. They're going to make it harder to create jobs by building the housing that we need or the roads and bridges that we need. They're going to go after Social Security, absolutely. So I think Frank's point is we have got to make them spell it out, and then we have to tell the American people exactly what they are doing. Their job is to protect the wealthiest people in this country who pay for their campaigns, and they're doing it by going to war against working families. And we have got to document that as clearly as we can.
Al, watch us on Free Speech TV on cable TV in Des Moines, Iowa. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator Sanders, great job. It seems like most of everything that we talk about is all different parts of what is referred to as the corporate takeover to globalization. Mm-hmm. Everything from the privatizing of the post office. When the corporation takes it over, they're actually going to steal those billions that have been put away for the retirement. And it seems like they become stronger and stronger every year, and us, the people, are getting behind the curve. And you seem to be our main fighter that we have for us. Do you really think that we're going to be able to beat the corporations or not?
Well, Al, I think you've asked maybe Tom, we got a lot of good questions today, really right on the mark, but maybe Al gets to the root of everything. And first of all, Al, let me be clear. I do this show every week, and many people are familiar with me, but there are a lot of people in Congress, a minority to be sure, but many dozens of members of the House and Senate who work very hard on behalf of working people, a lot more than just me. But, Al, this is what we're up against. We are up against a situation in which the people on top have unbelievable sums of money. And with that money, they hire lobbyists to push their legislation. They are prepared and have shut down thousands of factories in America and sent them to China. They avoid paying U.S. taxes by putting their money in the Cayman Islands and elsewhere. And their greed appears to have no end. They want more, more, and more. I myself don't know how you spend hundreds of millions of dollars, but that's apparently their goal. They want more and more and more. So we have a real tough fight on our hands, and I wouldn't kid you on that. The Republican Party has become an extreme right-wing party. The Democratic Party is much too conservative to my mind. But all I can say to you, Al, is that we got to continue the fight. You know, Martin Luther King Jr. talked about the arc of history being long but bending toward justice. These are tough times in our country for working people. But if you look at American history, sometimes surprising things happen at surprising times. No one would have believed 20 or 30 years ago that you would have had an African-American as president of the United States. We have made huge progress in recent years on women's rights, on gay rights, and in other areas. But in terms of the needs of working families and the economy, we are losing ground, and we have to figure out ways to bring our people together to stand up to these very powerful special interests.
Dude, Bernie, we have about a minute and a half here for you to wrap up the week, and what do we see coming with the week ahead?
Well, let me, you know, just pick it up from Al's very good question. We've got to stay focused on the real issues, and often media doesn't do that. They're into gossip. They're into speculation. Stay focused. What are the issues? The issues are the decline of America's middle class and the growing gap between the very, very wealthy and everybody else. What's the goal? The goal is, how do you create a full employment economy which provides decent paying jobs for our people? That takes you to the whole issue of globalization. It takes you to the issue of right to work and the role of unions in our economy. It takes you to the issue of rebuilding our manufacturing sector so that we produce the products in this country that people consume. It takes you, in terms of beyond jobs, the deficit reduction, doing it in a fair way. We are not going to, if I have anything to say about it for sure, we are not going to do what the Republicans want and what the president, he worries me very much about this, cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicare on a chain CPI, veterans programs. We've got to fight against that. So bottom line, we got to stand together, know what we're fighting for, and be prepared to take on some very powerful special interests.
Senator Bernie Sanders. Bernie, thank you so much for being with us again this week.
My pleasure.
Great talking with you. For our Blizzard with Bernie. We'll be back with Anything Goes Friday. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. It is Friday, where Anything Goes Friday today, whatever you want to talk about. Although, of course, the global warming, you know, they are going to be ridiculing it, of course, on the right. In fact, there's a great piece, the graphic over on at the top of DU today. Weather advisory, be prepared for up to 2 feet of snow, blizzard conditions, coastal flooding, wind gusts up to 70 miles an hour, and a dramatic increase in... I won't use their word. I'll just say idiots on Facebook crowing about how global warming doesn't exist. All right. Actually, this is global warming. I mean, this is the kind of thing that you, just like you can't say that cancer was caused by that cigarette or, you know, by that plastic bottle or whatever it may be. This is the kind of thing where there is a cause effect relationship. It may not be direct. It may not be specific, but what the global warming, a.k.a. global climate change models, predict is that storms become more severe. There's 5% more moisture now in the atmosphere than there was just 20 years ago. More moisture in the atmosphere makes for a more unstable atmosphere, makes for more radical weather conditions, and more radical weather conditions means things like the storm of the century, instead of happening once a century, happens every 4 or 5 years, and or every decade, or every 2 decades. And on the heels of Sandy, now we've got this storm. What is it? Nemo. Oh my, perfect name. So, anyhow, that's going on. John Kasich is in Ohio trying to screw the good people of Ohio. He's proposing a tax bill that will cut taxes on rich people, cut income taxes, and meanwhile will raise sales taxes. So, if you're in the bottom three quarters of American earners who live virtually hand-to-mouth, who spend every penny you get, then 100% of your income, will be taxed because you buy things with it. So you're going to be hit with a sales tax if you live in Ohio. But if you're among the wealthy folks in Ohio who take, you know, a good chunk of what you earn, and instead of spending it, you invest it in the stock market or you put it in a Swiss bank account, no tax at all, and in fact, your income taxes are going to go down. And Kasich isn't unique in this. Sam Brownback, a Republican governor of Kansas, is proposing that in Kansas. Dave Heinemann, the Republican in Nebraska, Bobby Jindal, the Republican in Louisiana, they're all proposing the same kind of thing. This is the new Republican thing. I mean, there's all these things from you know, the ALEC-inspired legislation to kill a post office back in 2006 to this kind of stuff, and you can track so much of this stuff back to the Koch brothers and other billionaires like them who are pushing agendas that are turning American democracy into an American plutocracy, an oligarchy. And it's an oligarchy that just ain't a good thing. Steve in Haymarket, Virginia. Tom talks about the poor, but the poor are hurt by the monetary policy of the Democrat Party.
Yes, sir.
First of all, there is no such thing as a Democrat Party. There is the Democratic Party. I know, you know, Joe McCarthy tried to, you know, make a joke about it and emphasize the word rat and call it the Democrat Party, but it was named by Thomas Jefferson, the Democratic Party, the Democratic Republican Party at the time. They dropped Republican in 1828. But,
I'm sorry, Tom.
Just.
Yeah, I should have called it what it is, the Fascist Party.
Okay.
But anyway.
All right.
But in other words, you're printing money, which is reducing the value of money. It's so much so that the Chinese will not sell us lithium anymore. And then you're making it a mandatory.
Steve, how is any of this? First of all, I'm not printing money, and to the best of my knowledge, the Democratic Party isn't printing money. And what is the specific Democratic Party policy? Are you opposed to, for example, to the legislation that actually passed the democratically controlled House of Representatives that would have cut tax breaks for companies that ship our jobs overseas and given tax breaks to companies that bring our jobs back that was shot down by the Republicans? I mean, what? Give me a specific piece of legislation or policy where you see the Democrats as wrong and the Republicans as right. Just one.
The Timmy Geithner and
just one piece of legislation.
Anyone. Reserve.
One piece of legislation. I can give you a long list of legislation. You know, everything from the middle class, the largest middle class tax cut in the history of the United States that Barack Obama did, saving Chrysler, saving GM, 800,000 monthly job losses turned into monthly job gains, the education spending increase, the student loan costs decreased, hate crime laws strengthened, Affordable Care Act, the Children's Health Insurance Program expanded, the Wall Street reform, credit card reform, predatory lending to soldiers banned, troops paid for stop loss time, torture stopped, Veterans Administration spending increased, women can now serve on submarines and in combat, equal pay for women, nuclear arms reduction and disposal programs. I mean, all of these things are the things that happened during that 2.5 month window when the Democrats controlled both the House and the Senate and the White House before Senator Brown was elected from Massachusetts, and the Republicans began to filibuster things. So again, I'll give you a long list of specific pieces of legislation where I think the Democrats have helped this country. And I can give you a list where I think the Republicans are doing stupid and destructive things. But I would just like you to provide me with one piece of legislation, one piece of law where, you know, that's been promoted by Democrats that you think will harm this country.
All of them together.
Just one.
That the rich have gotten richer and the poor have gotten poorer.
Just one piece of legislation.
All of them. Every single thing you mentioned.
Name.
Has caused a disastrous effect on the poor and has, in fact, increased the risk.
Just one piece of legislation, Steve, so we can actually talk about specifics.
All right. Cap and trade global warming legislation by Gary Connolly, my congressman.
Okay.
Even though I handed him 32,000 petition signed by actual climate scientists.
Right. Let's talk about that. Steve,
problem.
do you know the history of cap and trade in the United States?
The history of cap and trade is irrelevant. It's the effects that I look at.
Well, the history tells us what the effects are. Back when George Herbert Walker Bush was president of the United States, that we had this problem, which had been building over about 20 or 30 years, of acid rain. Remember the old acid rain problem?
And you know what caused it?
Sulfur dioxide. And you know what cleaned up
clean air.
You know what cleaned up the sulfur dioxide in the air? Do you know why there's no?
There was no sulfur dioxide in here. What happened was we had like a lot of dirt and everything getting into the, and it was causing it to lose its acidity. The pollution caused it to lose its acidity. When they did a study, a $600 million study, where they went into the bottoms of of ponds all over the United States, and they discovered that before 1920, the acidity in the ponds was equal to what it was, after today.
Well, you know, maybe in the world in which you live, that's true. But in the world in which George Herbert Walker Bush lived, and I live, and I think most scientists do, we had a problem with sulfur dioxide emissions, principally from coal-fired power plants around the United States. So what George Herbert Walker Bush did is he put into place a cap and trade program where he said, okay, we're going to say right now there will be no increase in the amount of sulfur dioxide that can be released by these factories or by these coal-fired power plants. And over a 40-year period, there will be a steady decline in the amount of permits that we're going to allow. And we're going to let companies trade and sell to each other credits for, you know, basically pollution credits for sulfur dioxide. And that cap and trade program succeeded. Not only in, you know, you could say it helped out some banksters, it made some money for some bankers, but it also got the sulfur dioxide out of our air. I'm not a huge fan of cap and trade, but it has been proved to work, and it was a Republican program, and it was a Republican president, and you know, working with the Democratic Congress that made it work. Go back and check the history, Steve.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I don't get it. You know, one piece of legislation, just one. 15 minutes past the hour. I find the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman with you, Marcia, listening to WCPT in, you must be listening
Raleigh.
To the live stream because you're in Angier, North Carolina.
Yeah, I listen. I live in North Carolina, and I have to listen on internet or through my cell phone.
Uh huh. So what's up?
Thank you for your service.
Sure.
I just want to say that we're out here and we are working on reforming voting. I think I contacted you before and I told you about my project, Equal Access Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
And then through that work, I found something you did with a coalition of people with No More Stolen Elections,
mm-hmm.
and you wrote a Voters' Bill of Rights. And we've combined that. And then through that work, I found other people who also are interested in reforming voting. And I found this guy. His name is Jim Mueller, and he's written something called Choice of Representation. And this is a gem, Tom.
Mm.
What this is, you know how in elections, if the Democrats win, then 50% are unhappy, Republicans or what have you. They're unhappy with the elections. And the same happens vice versa. If they win, 50% of the people are unhappy. Well, he's found a way where everybody will be able to be represented. And simply stated, it's each representative will have the voting power equal to the amount of people who voted for them. So your representative will be in Congress, and if 1,000 people voted for them, he'll have 1,000 points of power to put towards a bill. Instead of the representatives being equal, the people are equal. I mean, this is fantastic. That means everybody can come. Libertarians, Green Party, Constitution Party, everybody will be at the table because nobody will be turned away as a representative because everybody who runs will have somebody there. You just won't have
this
the
almost sounds
power.
like the next evolution of proportional representation, but it would require a significant amendment of our Constitution for that to happen at the federal level.
We're working on a document, and we're going to take it to the streets, Tom. We're going to do this.
Yeah.
We're going to do this.
Well, good on you, Marcia.
You're going to see it. Anybody who wants to help us, either come to the Equal Access Amendment Project or Choice of Representation on Facebook. People say they want to know what to do. Come and help us write it.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot for the info, and we'll see where we go from here. Keep us up to date, Marcia. I appreciate the call. Ryan in Spokane, Washington. Hey, Ryan, what's up? Hang on just a second here. There we go. For some reason, kept Marcia on, and it also put Ryan on at the same time. Hey, Ryan. Can you hear me?
Hey, how are you?
What's up?
I just want to talk a little bit about global warming.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an expert, but I believe we've had an ice age, possibly two of them already, I believe.
What are you talking about?
The Earth. We've gone through an ice age as a, you know.
We came out of an ice age. Well, it depends on how you define ice age, but yeah, North America and Northern Europe came out of an ice age about 11,000 years ago, I think.
Right. Okay. And something killed the dinosaurs. The bottom
line, it was actually
an
asteroid 65 million years ago. It created that big hole in the ocean next to Cancun.
Okay. Well, here's my point. I don't see how we're possibly going to buy our way out of global warming. We've already had an ice age, and we weren't here with our machines and our pollution. We weren't driving our cars bumper to bumper for an hour every day.
Right.
Our stupid job, you know. And anyway, so it happened anyway. For us to think that our government, who can't agree on anything, is going to be able to take money from the working class and turn that money into a way to actually reduce pollution, especially when we're controlled by the big bankers.
Ryan, I don't know if anybody who's saying that the government should take money from the working class and do anything about pollution, but the fact of the matter is that we are changing the atmosphere more rapidly than anything other than an asteroid hitting the Earth. I mean, this is not about the North Atlantic stream shutting down and causing the ice age. We're talking about, you know, the levels of carbon dioxide pushing 400 parts per million in our atmosphere. I mean, you know, check out the basic science on this. We're rendering the Earth uninhabitable for humans, and that's not a good thing. And we're doing it so that people like the Koch brothers can make more profit.
How do you feel about this? Companies get huge tax breaks for planting 2,000, 3,000 trees. Because we know that the trees are actually feeding off pollution.
Trees will sequester carbon for 100 years. That's no solution.
A tree will
take carbon out of the atmosphere and hold it for 100 years. Eventually, that tree dies and rots, and the carbon goes back into the air. We're taking carbon that was pulled out of our atmosphere during the Carboniferous period, when the planet was very different and we probably couldn't have survived on it 300, 400, 500 million years ago. That carbon was pulled out of the atmosphere and by plants and by huge mats of algae in the oceans. And that is what we call now coal and oil. And we're taking that carbon that over hundreds of millions of years was sequestered in the Earth, and we're releasing it. Every year we're releasing millions of years worth of carbon back into the atmosphere, and we're turning the atmosphere back into something like it was 300 million years ago before there were any humans. In other words, a world that's not adapted to us. And it's going to be a real problem for our children and our grandchildren if we don't stop doing that. And there are alternatives. I mean, Australia right now is saying, you know, it is cheaper to do wind power and solar power than it is to do coal or oil. And in fact, in the United States, it would be cheaper to do solar power and wind power than coal or oil if we simply added into the cost of oil and coal the actual costs associated with it, the cost of the military to protect the shipping lanes for the oil, the cost of the asthmas and cancers that are produced by tailpipe emissions, the cost of the cancers caused by the refining process. If we simply had the oil industry pay for those things instead of you and me paying for those with our taxes, wind and solar would be so much cheaper that this whole country would change just like that, and we would stop putting all this crap in the air.
Okay, I'm not going to disagree with you completely. Can I make a quick point?
You got 20 seconds.
Okay, perfect. We have 100 years worth of natural gas. We know that that's a hell of a lot better when it comes out of your vehicle than what we're currently using. We've been buying off Saudi Arabia for a long time, which is keeping America broke. Why don't, for 25 years, we use one quarter of the gas we already have, which is natural, to get the vehicle switched over to it. That's going to make the food a lot cheaper at the supermarket.
Yeah, Ryan, you're out of time.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Yeah, I think it's a transition for large vehicles, for 18-wheelers. Natural gas actually makes some sense. As a transition for cars, we should be using electricity. 34 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. One caller today is going to receive a free signed copy of my book, Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision, my book on political communications. Free signed copy of Cracking the Code will be sent using stamps.com. That caller could be you. So it's particularly appropriate for Anything Goes Friday. Matt in Marquette, Michigan. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. You want to talk about global warming?
Yeah, I do. And I want to talk about the far reach of factory farming. I just recently watched a very interesting documentary called Farmageddon. It was discussing how the, you know, a lot of the lobbyists from the factory farming corporations are in bed with pharmaceutical agencies and gain positions in the USDA and the FDA, and how they then come in and really oppress small local organic farmers. There was a case in 2010 where a gentleman had $65,000 worth of raw milk product seized by the government, stating that it was unhealthy. And in a lot of states, such as Maryland, it's illegal to sell or buy raw milk. In that court case, they ruled that there is no right to consume or feed any particular food to children, and there is no generalized right to bodily health or bodily and or physical health, which I don't quite understand how you can have the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness without bodily
or
physical health.
Well, Matt, the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness is explicated in or laid out, stated in the Declaration of Independence, which is a founding document of the United States, but it's not a legal document. It is not part of our law.
Sure, I understand. We're just so upside down from what our founding fathers had envisioned. It would be wonderful to get back to that place. And I guess, you know, in addition, to tie it back to global warming, if you look at the practices of a lot of local and organic farmers, they leave a much smaller footprint,
yep,
as I'm sure you know, on
yep,
on our world than these factory farms do, you know,
yeah,
not to mention the
buy small, buy local.
Of the animals.
Yeah.
I couldn't agree more.
Totally with you, Matt. Yeah. Excellent point. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Oh, that's interesting. Lil. No, I got a. Huh. For some reason, put Matt on, drop him. Lil in Dexter, Oregon. Hey, Lil, what's up?
Hey, how you doing? And thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm not very hip on political, but once in a while I see somebody come on and they're fighting for the oil company loopholes.
Mm-hmm.
They're not paying what they should pay. And I wonder if you could enlighten me a little bit on that. And one other thing I'd like to say. I did go to sign Bernie's petition, but it would not work. When I pushed the petition button, it wouldn't go through.
Oh, really? Oh, you should call his office or send him a note on it.
I'm trying because I'm definitely on that one.
Yeah.
But anyway, on the oil companies, if you could inform me a little bit on that, I'd sure appreciate it.
Well, they've got a whole bunch of different loopholes. Probably the most egregious is the oil depletion allowance. And basically what that says is you got an oil well. It's got a fair amount of oil in it. But as you pump the oil out of it, it's going to become worth less and less because there's less and less oil. Now, you know, that's true. Nobody disagrees with that. That's sort of like saying, hey, I got an age depletion allowance, okay? You know, eventually I'll get too old to do talk radio and I'll die, you know? But what the government does with the oil companies is they say, as the oil decreases, we're going to give you huge tax breaks or even refunds to make up for the fact that you're running out of oil. Whereas they're not saying to you and me, well, gee, you know, as you're running out of steam, we're, you know, or to a business, you know, that's anything else. So these and it's not just oil, by the way. Many of the extractive industries have variations on this, and it's a scam. It's just a scam. They're
totally.
You know, ExxonMobil was the most profitable corporation on planet Earth last year, hundreds of billions of dollars in profits. And they got a refund from the federal government, and this is one of many kinds of special loopholes that are written into the tax code just for the oil industry. And we're not asking them to pay for the cancers that they're causing, and we're not asking them to pay for the damage that global warming is causing, and we're not asking them to pay for the Navy protecting their shipping lanes or the Marines going in and taking Kuwait so that we could sell, you know, we could buy that oil that Saddam had nationalized.
Well,
now
what you're telling me is it's so heavily loaded on the oil side. What's wrong with this picture? Why isn't anybody fighting all of that?
Well, it all has to do with money. I mean, Bernie Sanders is one of those rare guys who's in a great situation in as much as there's only 600,000 people in the state of Vermont. And, you know, in the course of 30 years in politics, he's probably shaken the hand of every single person in that state twice. And people know him. He can do retail politics. You know, he just ran for re-election in this last election cycle. The guy running up against him spent millions of dollars. Bernie did not buy one television ad. Didn't spend a dollar on a television ad. Instead, what he did was he held town hall meetings all over the state. He worked his butt off tirelessly. I've watched him do it. I've been with him at several of these meetings. And back when I was a Vermont voter before I started this radio show, I've been to his town meetings. And he just works his butt off and people know it. But you can't do that if you're the senator from California or New York or even a medium large state like Ohio or Michigan or something like that. It's much, much harder to do. And so what happens is big money comes in and starts influencing these elections. And this is, you know, one of the really big problems that we have is that since the Supreme Court has said that billionaires should have a billion times more a louder voice than you or me, and that corporations should have voices as if they're people because they're persons, and, you know, that money is equal to speech, since the Supreme Court has laid this on us, as President Obama predicted, it has twisted and distorted our elections to the point that even Obama himself is having to dance to the tune of a lot of these guys if he wants to have him or his own political party have any political future. It's a real tragedy. Lil, I got to move along, but thank you for the call. You are you're really nailing it here. Mona in Granada Hills, California. Hello?
It's Mona.
Mona. Hey, what's
actually,
up?
Actually, Ramona.
Ramona, you are on the air.
I want to thank you for all the good work you do, and we want to hear you on KPFK in the out here in Los Angeles, and the time zone's been changed. I mean, it's always changed. But what I wanted to tell you about, a friend of mine who has prosthetic legs, one of them broke, and she lives here in the high desert. Mm-hmm. And she went to, I think it was FedEx, to have it shipped to New York. And they were going to charge her $800. And, you know, she was shocked. And this was going to take 5 days, and she couldn't afford that. Who can afford that? Except maybe the very rich. Then she went to the post, the U.S. Post Office, and it was under $200, and it was next day.
Wow.
So if things get privatized, I can't even imagine what's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, this is.
It scares me.
Yeah, me too. I mean, we're seeing an American institution being destroyed by. And we had a caller earlier who said that this piece of legislation that it has devastated the post office was pushed in 2006 actually came out of the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, which is, you know, of course, the Koch brothers' favorite little toy for making legislation. I don't know if that's true or not. If it is, that's a pretty horrific thing. Mona, thanks a lot for the call. Amazing, amazing. Rob in Chicago, you want to talk about the last ice age?
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. That gentleman from Washington was talking about the last ice age and how we weren't here driving our cars. As I remember, as it was taught to me, the last ice age was actually created by volcanoes dumping a lot of carbon dioxide and monoxide into the atmosphere, thereby actually blocking sunlight and cooling it. Yeah. And then once
it wasn't carbon dioxide, monoxide, it was particulate matter. Yeah, it's called the albedo effect. It was reflecting sunlight out. And I think you're referring to the Little Ice Age. But there are, you know, there are regular, you know, these 14,000-year cycles, and there's 28,000-year cycles. There are these perturbations of the atmosphere, these variations which are natural. But what we're producing right now is not natural. And it's not
exactly
within the range of natural. And those variations are not 5 and 6 and 8 and 10 degree Celsius variations. They're 2 and 3 degree variations, which is enough to produce an ice age. And we're talking about
That's exactly my point. Right. We're artificially doing it.
Yeah,
right,
and
now
we're doing it in a way that will do more than just create an ice age. It could repeat the Permian extinction. We could sterilize the Earth, where 95% of all life dies. And that is not someplace we want to go, and we've got to do something about this fairly soon. Thank you, Rob, for the call. Bart in Redwood Valley, California, says you disagree with me about peak oil.
Hello.
Hey, Bart, you're on the air.
Oh.
We have 1 minute.
Yes.
Thank you, Rob.
You should research this, because for a long time it's been known that oil and hydrocarbons come up from the magma. There's a Russian-Ukrainian theory of abiotic hydrocarbon formation, which completely explains the origins of oil. The origins of oil are in the magma. They know the chemical equation.
I'm familiar with the hypothesis, and one of the things that indicates
theory.
Its possibility is the hydrogen signature, a particular isotope of hydrogen being there. But that doesn't account for the vast majority of the oil that's out there, Bart.
Yes, it does. You have to break the trance that people are in over the relationship between oil.
Okay.
Regardless
of where the oil came from, is it a wise idea for us to be bringing this hydrocarbon to the surface, burning it, and releasing that carbon into the atmosphere?
It isn't. However,
okay. Great. Then we can agree that we may disagree with where oil came from, but the fact of the matter is that burning it is stupid, and we agree on that. Bart, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The guy who did most of the writing, by the way, on the hypothesis that the fellow was just talking about is a fellow by the name of Gold. You can probably Google it. Gold, deep hot oil hypothesis would probably bring it up. It's the place where smart people get their news. And speaking of the news, brought to you by Goats for the Old Goat. This Valentine's Day, you can give a crystal heart made by women recovering from the effects of war in South Sudan at goatsfortheoldgoat.com. Just click the donate button. It'll take you to the store. And Victoria Jones is on the line with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's going on in the world today?
Well, I just heard you talking about Keystone, so I thought I'd give you three environmental stories to lead with and then see where we go.
Okay.
The EPA today announced that it's formally moving forward with its climate change adaptation plan. What this is now accepting comments on its draft plan. It calls for the agency to amend its operations beginning today, including the promulgation of new regulations to account for increasingly rapid global warming.
Huh.
So everything now takes that into account. Rising sea levels, loss of snowpack, drought linked to climate change will require likely the agency to take additional steps to protect watersheds, wetlands, and water supplies.
This seems like a good thing.
Potentially it is.
Yeah.
So this is really interesting. Increasing temperature is going to mean new measures to protect public safety, adapt emergency response plans, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that happened today.
Okay. Story one.
Also, story two. Alaska Senators Mark Begich and Lisa Murkowski, bipartisan, have just introduced two bills to prevent the sale of genetically altered salmon.
Whoa!
Yes.
Well, salmon is sort of sacred in Alaska. That makes a lot of sense. Good on them.
Yes, saying we cannot afford to experiment with the world's largest wild salmon stocks without the certainty these fake fish won't pose a serious environmental risk, Begich said. Murkowski went further. We have scientists splicing fish DNA with an antifreeze-like chemical compound and considering feeding that to Americans, Murkowski said. That kind of idea didn't work out so well in Jurassic Park, and I don't think we should be going down that dangerous road with a perfect natural brain food like salmon.
I never, ever thought I'd agree with Barbara Murkowski, but I do.
There you go.
It's hyperbolic, but I think it's well said. Okay, story three.
Senator Lisa Murkowski, Alaska again, might hold up Senate confirmation of President Obama's nominee for Interior Secretary Sally Jewell because the Interior Department won't approve construction of a road that Alaskan lawmakers call vital to health care access for a remote Aleutian village called King Cove. Now, Interior said this week that it's not going to allow a road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge, which is a project that advocates say is needed so that residents of King Cove can reach an all-weather airport in Cold Bay for medical evacuations. They've got no other way of getting there, and there have been a number of fatal accidents in the plane that they've been using. Murkowski is so angry that even though she believes that the president should have his own choices for the cabinet, that she's considering placing a procedural hold on the nomination of Sally Jewell.
Wow.
Because
do you think
she wants these Aleutians to have their road.
Right. Where's the opposition to the road coming from?
It's coming for Fish and Wildlife from Interior. They say,
okay. which is the White House.
Right. They say it will protect the heart of a pristine landscape that right. Congress designated as a wilderness and that serves as vital habitat for grizzly bear, caribou, and salmon, shorebirds, and waterfowl, including 98% of the world's population of Pacific black brant.
Huh. Interesting. Well, it's going to be this will be an interesting one to watch play out. I could see how you could argue either side of this one.
Exactly. And the King Cove residents are saying, look, we've tried doing it other ways. We need a road. Over the past 30 years, Murkowski says, more than a dozen people have died and many others have been injured from aviation accidents involving airplanes flying into or out of King Cove. It's that dangerous to get to this village.
Right. Okay.
Very interesting story.
Yep. So what else is up in the world?
Well, those are my environmental stories for you. Okay. Today at the White House, I was at the briefing, Jay Carney said that what the Republicans are saying about sequester, the automatic cuts, and trying to place blame for it on the White House, he called it a fanciful confection and a lot of baloney. This idea that it's President Obama's idea and that he's in favor of it.
Well, there is some evidence that he was not opposed to it, and that but the fact of the matter is that more Republicans than Democrats voted for the sequester. Why don't they just stand up and own it? Why don't they brag about it actually?
Because they know that the cuts are going to bite them on the bottom.
But they want to say, hey, we're being fiscally responsible. Here's their opportunity. Oh yeah, that's right. The cuts are going to bite them on the bottom.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. So the White House today put out this,
okay.
which is sequestration impacts, which you can find at whitehouse.gov.
Uh-huh.
And it will scare the pants off your bottom, actually,
okay.
about cuts to education, cuts to the FBI, NIH research, U.S. attorneys, emergency responders, all the cuts, who is going to cut, what are the effects going to be domestically. We've been hearing about the defense cuts. Now they want people to know about the domestic cuts. They want people to start getting freaked out. That's prior to the State of the Union on Tuesday when the president is really going to lay out the case.
Now, any change to sequestration has to originate in the House of Representatives because it has to do with revenue and or spending, in particular spending. And so is there a schism between the John Boehner kind of, let's say, Karl Rove Republicans and the Eric Cantor, let's say, Tea Party Republicans on this issue?
There doesn't seem to be at the moment. Mm-hmm. If you ask me in 10 days' time, around about the 18th of February, as
right.
the countdown begins, I think we might start to see those
yeah.
splits.
Very, very interesting. But right now, are they proposing to do anything about the sequester very quickly?
Yes, they want a package, and they want the package of cuts.
Oh, okay. And including Medicare and stuff like that, right?
Everything should be on the table.
Yes, of course. Okay. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
And goatsfortheoldgoat.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, just so it doesn't go down the memory hole, welcome back to the third hour of our program. Just so it doesn't go down the memory hole, remember when John Boehner a couple of years back said he was negotiating with President Obama and he got 98% of what he wanted? He was quite proud of himself. He said, I got 98% of what I wanted. I'm pretty happy. That was the sequester. That deal was just so it doesn't go down the memory hole, just so you remember, that deal was the sequester. And now Boehner is tweeting out, he's got a new hashtag, Obama sequester. He's trying to call it Obama sequester. I find this fascinating. What I find even more fascinating is that I'll bet that in the national corporate largely Republican media that you have been watching and listening to for the last few, well, the last 2 years or so since John Boehner got his sequester, that you haven't heard once, at least in the last 6 months, that when John Boehner bragged that he got 95%, 98% of what he wanted, that that was the sequester. Let us not forget. By the way, last week I told you the story, or was it early this week? I guess it was last week. Yeah, I told you the story of when it was freezing here in Washington D.C. and they were blowing bubbles underneath the. You know, we live in this boat in the marina here. Louise and I bought this almost 30-year-old boat that's in one of the Washington marinas. It's actually a very economical and kind of cozy way to live. Other than the fact that in the winter you don't have water and things. And we had these bubbles, you know, coming up, and I thought the boat was sinking, and I was running around, you know, looking for things like birth certificates and whatnot, pictures, you know, and it was midnight, and, you know, I was doing this in my underwear, and it just, you know, it was. Yeah, no, George Bush would paint it. Have you seen this? George Bush, he's painting, you know, nude pictures of himself in the bathtub in the shower. Does the word narcissist come to mind? Anyhow, at the time I was telling you how, you know, we'd run out of water on our boat because the water lines were frozen, and the hose that I used to you know, because during the winter during the summer you actually hook the boat up to the city water through a hose. And, but you have to turn that off every day when you leave, because if anything springs a leak in the boat, it'll fill up with water and sink, which happens, you know, to boats from time to time. I guess on the average about one every other year around here. And about half the time we were forgetting to turn off the water when we left. So it's a good habit to get into. But in any case, in the winter, they turn off the water for you because, you know, the pipes will freeze. But there is this one line that you can hook to with a hose. So you got to run this hose down the dock and plug it into this one line that they let drip at the very end of the dock, and for what's called winter water to refill the water tank in your boat, because there's this 160-gallon water tank in the boat, so that I can take a shower and use the bathroom and you know, we can wash the dishes and stuff like that, and put some water in the cat bowl. And I was concerned because I couldn't refill the water, and so I was running down to the security office. They've got a shower and a bathroom there, and I was using the shower there and I was using the bathroom there because I couldn't figure out how to make the water work. And I just kind of thought that's the way it was. I'm just stuck with this because my hose was frozen. And so I was talking to my neighbor about this. I haven't told this part of the story yet. This is one of those live and learn stories. So I was talking to my neighbor about it over the weekend after I'd gotten back from Minneapolis. And, you know, I says, you know, this is really tough. You know, I hope it thaws out because, you know, this hose, I mean, there's water in the winter water pipe, but I can't get it into my boat because my hose is frozen. And he's like, well, just, you know, roll the hose up and take it indoors and let it thaw out. It takes about 2 hours. And then go out and, you know, real quickly, well, before it freezes again, refill your water tank. So I did that, and ta-da, I've got a shower again. So, which is really cool. I mean, you know, we still have, there's still some challenges, but live and learn. So anyway, that's just to bring you up to date on the weirdnesses of our life. It's anything goes. So Friday. So your thoughts, Mike. You're a chemical engineer. You wanted to talk about what is the source of oil, or where oil comes from, or what?
Well, I wanted to kind of refute the comment that the guy made about oil coming from magma. That's
right.
Absolutely ludicrous. And what you've been saying about the sequester of these large quantities of carbon over hundreds of millions of years is actually very correct.
Yeah, I know.
So, you know, I just
I know.
Find it.
But there is, you know, this guy named Gold came up with this this hypothesis that there was a hyperthermic bacterium that was capable of producing some small quantity of oil out of some type of rock, and this would not be magma.
The carbon and hydrogen being combined into a hydrocarbon by these bacteria, but the amounts that are produced are so minuscule.
Small.
The other thing I wanted to say is we've got two very innovative projects in alternative energy going down here in Southern California. Actually, one's just across the Arizona-California border, but I work for a company called Symbol Materials, and we're producing lithium from geothermal brines down here. And the lithium deposit here in Southern California is probably one of the largest in the world, and we're hoping to bring the battery market and the EV car manufacturing market to Southern California, where the employment rate is upwards of 30%.
So by geothermal brines, you're talking about basically the hot water that comes out of the, like, you know, Old Yeller, you know, or no, what's the old, the Old Reliable?
Old Faithful.
San
Andreas. But the San Andreas comes down Southern California, it goes through the Salton Sea, and south of the Salton Sea, it sidesteps a bunch, and there's a very large geothermal magmatic intrusion there, and the water that has come down there, it does all the solution mining for us, and and half the periodic table are in these brines that the geothermal industry brings up, flashes the steam to produce the energy, and reinjects the brines back down into the ground so that there's no environmental consequence, and we borrow those geothermal brines from them for about 90 minutes and produce lithium and zinc and manganese and potassium and various other things down the road.
What do you do about the toxic byproducts, the lead and the actinides and the high levels of things like cadmium?
They end up back down in the reservoir.
Oh, okay. So you pump them back down where they came from.
That's correct. And the other project is by a company called EnviroMission. It's a hybrid solar wind power that is a very innovative technology. It's going to be the second tallest structure on the planet. The Southern California Power Agency has already bought the power rights to the first two of these. Each will produce 200 megawatts. And the thing about this technology is it produces the energy basically through the Carnot cycle, which is just a thermal difference between ground temperature and the temperature at 2,870 feet
on
top of this chimney.
Right.
And so you have a 1 mile in diameter, actually 1 mile in radius, greenhouse that leads to the base of the solar chimney.
That is so cool. That's what, probably about a 4 or 5 degree Fahrenheit difference?
Oh, it's a lot more than that.
If you're doing it as a greenhouse, it's got to be a hell of a lot more than that. Huh, fascinating. Mike, thank you for the call. I'm sorry we're out of time. That's great.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
See, these are the things that make me think it's not all gloom and doom, and we're not going to repeat the Permian extinction. We will think our way out of this, or at least out of some of this, maybe most of it. The president goes skeet shooting. You know, first of all, they say he doesn't know. He's never shot a gun. So the White House releases a picture of the president. You know, with a looks like probably it's a 10 or 12 gauge shotgun firing off at skeet. Skeet are, for those of you who don't know, they're not living things. Sometimes you call them clay pigeons. They're these little things that look like a miniature frisbee, and you know you got this thing with an arm that goes whoosh like that and spins them out and. Into the sky, and I've shot skeet. It's a hoot. It's probably environmentally not the best thing in the world, because what are you doing? You know, you're blowing up gunpowder and you're sending lead out into the air, and it's ending up in the environment. And you know, you got to handle the stuff. And but you know, if you got to shoot something, skeet and target. At least. So anyhow, they said, the gun guys are going, all right, president. So the White House releases this picture of him out of Camp David skeet shooting from back last summer. And now they're going, oh, wow, it's got to be photoshopped. And it's become like the new birth certificate theory. I mean, there's this whole conspiracy, you know, oh, it was photo, like as if it matters. right? It's just bizarre. It's just bizarre. There's this alternative world that lives parallel to ours inside the Republican Party. Mike in Delano, Minnesota. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, thanks for taking my call, Tom. I've been on your show a bunch of times talking economics, and I've got a question for you. I have a family member who's a severely conservative economist, and she teaches micro and macro and international economics at a college in the Midwest. Anyway, she sent me a slide presentation from another conservative economist, and the point is that progressivism isn't efficient because it doesn't allocate scarce resources very well, and it does not allocate to their most highly valued use.
Right.
And the gist of it is that socialism and progressivism does not create wealth. I thought you were the perfect person to call to get your take on this.
Well, this is Milton Friedman 101. And, right. and there is some truth to it, actually. I mean, you know, Friedman's hypothesis was that here's your basic choice. You can have central planning. These are the two extremes, obviously. You know, the old Soviet five-year plan. You can have central planning where a bunch of people who might be the smartest people in the room sit around and say, what should we do for the next year? Okay, well, let's fix the price of corn at this, the price of wheat at that, the price of oil at that, and let's give these kind of incentives to make solar and you fix tax policy and incentive, you know, which is an incentive. You know, taxes are arguably the main reason for taxes is not just to raise revenue, it's to alter behavior. So you fix these policies in a way that you think is going to be best for society. On the other hand, you've got the so-called free market. You've got the marketplace where you have hundreds of millions of decisions being made by hundreds of millions of people, hundreds of billions of decisions being made every minute by hundreds of millions of people. And every one of those people is making a decision that they think is the best decision for them. Now, in many cases, those decisions are not the best decisions for them. In many cases, those decisions are skewed by things like advertising that gets people to buy things that are actually bad for them. But generally speaking, in a world where all things are true, where there's absolute access to information, which is one of the big holes in Friedman's theory, and everybody has the exact same information base, then the marketplace's decisions would certainly generally be optimal compared to the egghead's base, okay, to use the Friedman model. Now, here's where that starts to fall apart. That all makes perfect sense if you're trying to figure out what's the best kind of computer to have out in the marketplace or what's the best kind of car. Back when I lived in Germany, we were just, you know, a few miles from the East German border, and the East Germans had one kind of car. It was called the Trabi and Trabant. They called it the Trebis. And it was this little two-cycle engine that was just this god-awful thing. It made all kinds of terrible noise, and it smelled terribly. But it was the only kind of car you could buy because central planning, right? So if you want to decide what's the best kind of car to have, it's a good idea to have a relatively free marketplace where with competition. And you use the government to enforce that competition by preventing any one company from getting too large, you know, the Sherman Act kind of thing. In other words, regulated capitalism, some controls on capitalism so that they're actually that serve to enhance competition so that the marketplace actually is making rational decisions. That all actually has, you know, there's a lot of rationality to that. Where that breaks down is in two areas. The first is when it has to do with the commons, when it has to do with those things where there are natural monopolies. There are natural monopolies. How many power supplies can you get into your home? Only one. You know, only one power cable. How many water lines are you going to have into your home? How many sewer lines are you going to have going out of your home? How many, you know, and these kind of things. So you have these natural monopolies and you know, water system for the roads, things like this. These are the police departments, fire departments. These are not things that are best determined by competition or by the free market. They're best determined by the needs of society. And society needs to have its own internal marketplace to determine how these things should be done. And the best one that's been developed so far is called representative democracy. In other words, we hire people to administer these things, and if they do a crappy job, we fire them by elections and we hire new people. So that's one place where it breaks down. and you know is where Milton Friedman's theory breaks down is in the commons. And the second place where it breaks down is in what's called externalities. As long as companies can figure out ways to get you and me to deal with the externalities, in other words, the costs associated with their product, and then the marketplace isn't a genuine marketplace. For example, the oil industry. You and I are paying for the Navy to protect ExxonMobil's supply of oil into the United States. You and I are paying for the hospital admission visits for the people who get cancer from the kids with asthma. Those externalities are not being put into the equation, and so they're not part of the marketplace. And without a government, without governance, without we the people in some way applying those externalities and protecting the commons, then Friedman's theories become mush. What they become is chaos. They become a fang and claw world. Making sense, Mike?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Mike, was that a useful answer?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay, great. Thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. I mean, I could go into a whole lot more, and I'd encourage you to read my book, Scrooge, for more on that. So Marco Rubio is going to deliver the Republican response to the State of the Union address on Tuesday, and Rand Paul is going to deliver the crazy response, excuse me, the Tea Party response to the, you know, just to finish up that little rant about how Milton Friedman's free market stuff falls apart. Arguably the biggest hole in that theory about, you know, millions of people are going to make millions of decisions and those decisions are going to be more efficient and you know, all that kind of, is that it assumes perfect knowledge. And it actually made more sense back in the day of Adam Smith than it does today, and here's why. And by the way, this was not Adam Smith's theory as much as the Milton Friedman folks like to, the Chicago school boys, as they refer to themselves. Milton Friedman taught economics at the University of Chicago back in the 30s and 40s and 50s, and then in the 70s went and 80s tried to apply some of these theories to, for example, when Pinochet, the military dictator, took over Chile, Friedman came in as an economic advisor, totally screwed that country. I mean, they're still recovering from it. But in any case, the theory is that there's perfect knowledge. When Louise and I lived in Montpelier, Vermont, a little town of like 8,000 people, 7,900 people, something like that. It would double in size every day because it was the state capital. Government workers would come in from small towns around. But basically, it was fewer than 10,000 people, as I recall. And the smallest state capital in the United States, the only one that doesn't have a McDonald's. In fact, every other year, we would vote to tax ourselves to pay for the lawyer who is fighting the lawsuit against McDonald's to keep the McDonald's. But that's a whole other story. There was a doctor in town, an eye doctor, who was not very good, and he actually injured a couple of people. And word spread, and pretty soon nobody would go to him. And so he left. Now, that's the market working the way that a libertarian would have the market work. The problem, you know, one problem with that, of course, is that people have to get wounded before you know, right? But that's the libertarian argument against regulation. Is eventually people are going to find out who the bad guys are and who the good guys are. And it, because everybody has, you know, perfect knowledge of the quality and lack of quality of products and services, goods and services, they will ultimately make rational decisions. And arguably, that's a case of where it happened. Although, as I say, you know, some people had to be wounded for that to happen. But here's where it breaks down. I don't know where that doctor went, but what if he went to Manhattan? There are millions of people in Manhattan or New York City in general. What is it, 11, 12, 13 million people, some mind-boggling number of people? I mean, he could just kill person after person after blind person after person after person. And, you know, they could go back to their little community, their neighborhood, their six-square-block area where, you know, they might know, you know, 100 people or 200 people and tell everybody they know about this guy. And it still wouldn't affect his business because there's always another sucker. And that's the biggest problem with Milton theory, Milton Friedman's economic theory, with libertarian economic theory, with the conservative economic theory, is they always predicate this efficiency of the marketplace argument on the assumption of perfect knowledge, that everybody shares a knowledge base. And it is a fantasy. Ain't never been, will never be. The closest you can get to that is, like I said, small town America. But even there, you've got to deal, you know, there are people who aren't going to know. There are going to be some people who don't know how to understand the information. There are people who, you know, you say, you know, there will be people who, due to deficits in IQ or information or understanding or age, whatever it may be, they can't have perfect knowledge. And that's where this whole Friedman, libertarian, right-wing economic theory falls apart. It just absolutely falls apart. So, Marty in Evergreen Park, Illinois, listening on WCPT. Hey, Marty, it looks like you want to pick up a conversation I was having with the Independent Women's Forum person from yesterday.
Yeah.
Julie?
Yeah, exactly. Thanks, Tom, for taking my call. I was listening to that yesterday, and I was thinking, and I'm a parent of three children, and if there's anywhere where I want the government, I want them standardizing school lunch programs. I want nutrition to have, I want there to be a baseline nutrition level for school lunch programs.
Well, so do the school ladies, Marty. And after Julie repeatedly on this show said, you know, hundreds of lunch ladies in Chicago were protesting government standards. After we got off the air, Louise looked up the story, and sure enough, here are the, 100 lunch ladies out there protesting, and you read the article, and what were they protesting? They were protesting that the quality of the food wasn't good enough. They wanted better food for their kids. It wasn't that the government standards were too high or too onerous or too bad or whatever. It was that there wasn't enough funding, that the school, they wanted better food for their kids. It had nothing to do with regulations or standards.
Yeah, and there's some parts where there are food deserts where there are literally no access to healthy foods where, right. A lot of these students, in order to, in order to actually absorb information, you need nutrition. So, right. I mean, it's critical to have these programs implemented, and it's critical to have a standardized, to have a high level of quality to these programs because they are so essential. At least.
Yep.
That's the way I see it.
Yep. I'm totally with you. And I was disappointed when I read that article to find that that our guest from the Independent Women's Forum had been, in my opinion, misrepresenting in order to try to win an argument, that case. Marty, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. And for listening to WCPT, Tina in Jay, New York, watching on Free Speech TV. Hey, Tina, what's up?
Hi. First, I don't know how to put or what I want to say in a brief period because I want to respect your other listeners, but I can't thank you enough for the work that you do. I don't mean just being on the radio or on Free Speech, but to gather knowledge and then share it with us. I'm so grateful to you and your wife and your staff.
Thank you, okay. Tina. For me, it's fun. I can't think of anything I'd rather do. So.
It is an effort, and you may enjoy the effort, but it's not like you get it by osmosis through your antenna.
No, Louise and I, we both work 12-hour days, yeah.
Right, and I am so grateful and humbled
to you
for that.
Thank you.
Okay.
To your question.
You were talking about Milton free market standards. Another thing about it not working, at least in this country, is as consumers, we're stuck proving danger, whereas corporations don't have to prove safety in this country. Another big downside to free market, no regulation.
Mm-hmm.
But I called because a friend of mine mentioned hearing a story on the pseudo corporate news regarding Nancy Pelosi and her private jet and when she was Speaker of the House. And I asked this woman, I said, okay, in the news, did they tell you that more soldiers have committed suicide than died in combat in Iraq, and she didn't know that. And then I said, do you know the reason the speaker had a private plane is because she stood in line for the presidency, and she didn't know that. And then I brought it around to, in certain grades, they're taking up to 48 bubble tests a year. These bubble tests don't take into consideration poverty, culture, anything. And what they do is then judge the school and the teacher, and then they base their funding on these results. Hence, schools will close, public schools will close, private schools will win out, and who gets to go to private schools? Wealthy people. And from that contingent of making us less able to think, less trained to think, came the article and the news on your program that I learned about in Missouri, these legislators wanting to give six-year-olds gun training. And the gentleman, I think his name was Shane Farnan, had said that Missouri has one of the higher STD rates. And I'd been wanting to say this to you for a while. I thought to myself, well, perhaps since they don't have sex education and they're now deciding to give six-year-olds gun training, safety training, perhaps with these high STD rates, these legislators have tertiary syphilis.
Okay. I don't know if that came from Shano or not. It was in the news. Okay.
That's my idea.
Yeah. Okay.
He reported the story.
Tina, very interesting. Okay. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for sharing that with us. Who knows? I mean, tertiary syphilis. It's not inconceivable. Marcella in Stone Mountain, Georgia. We used to live in the northern Atlanta suburbs. I've been out to Stone Mountain a lot of times. It's a great area. Hey, Marcella. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air. We just have a minute.
Hey, how
break,
are you,
though.
Tom?
Great.
My husband, Jesse, and I just want to say thank you for all you do. And just like your last caller, I have a lot to say. First of all, I'd like to know if you know about the Venus Project.
Maybe, maybe not. Which one is that?
That's the one where everything is going to be automated and there's enough for abundance in the world for everybody.
I don't know about it, no.
Well, look it up online.
Okay.
It's pretty interesting. It's a nice concept. And there's a gentleman down in Florida that he's an engineer, and he has all the answers for that.
Okay.
The other thing is, are you familiar with Zygast? I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing it right, the movie.
I don't know about that one either.
Okay. Well, we just, before we tuned you in today, we were watching the amendum to the first Zygast. And that one talked about how money is created through debt and debt is created through money.
Right.
And one of your callers earlier had something to say about that.
No, I understand that, Marcella. We have a system in this country where we do create money through debt, and it's called a fractional reserve banking system. And I think it's a bad system. So I apparently agree with the movie. Marcella, thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Although I should be sure to say apparently, because I haven't seen it, so I don't know what's in it. It's Anything Goes Friday, 45 minutes past it. It's talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. And Mark Taylor Canfield on the line from Seattle. Hey, Mark, what's up? Oh,
hey, Tom. I've been covering some stories for Free Speech Radio and also writing at Truth Out. But last week, this, you know, Seattle introduced its gun buyback program. And on the first day, they recovered 716 weapons.
Wow.
Including a rocket launcher device.
Yeah, I saw that in the news. Yeah.
Yeah, but the city actually ended up giving away almost all of the money it had raised through private contributions in the police federation to fund that program. So in order to actually continue it, now they're going to have to raise more money.
Right.
And then today we're all talking about Mayor Mike McGinn's decision to order the police department to put a stop to the
proposed
drones over the city.
Yeah.
And the background on that is that there were some very, very contentious public meetings and a proposed vote by the city council to regulate those drones. And I think the mayor has just decided that the program's way too controversial and unpopular here to institute now.
Yeah.
But there's always that chance, you know, that the police department could come back.
It's not a chance, Mark. It's going to happen. You know, wait 2 or 3 years. I mean, I remember this in the 60s with helicopters, with police helicopters. It's like, you know, oh, my God, they're going to spy on us. There were people who were very concerned about that. There needs to be reason, at least with a helicopter, though, you could hear it. There needs to be reasonable restrictions on these things. I mean, you can't stop the ongoing march of technology, but there are right now. There's no rules, and that's what's so wrong about it. But they will come back. Mark Taylor Canfield, thanks for the call. By the way, thanks so much to our show director Louise Hartman, to my associate executive producer Sean Taylor, to our associate producer Shane Farnan, our video director, Jim Javinsky, our phone screener, Danielle Gilday, to our writer-researcher, Sam Sachs, to Albert Goldbook for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, all the groups that syndicate our program, Dial Global, Pacifica Radio, CRN Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, and all the cable providers that carry our show, Comcast, Manhattan Neighborhood Network, all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, and the folks in our chat room, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, and everyone at the Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you, our Friday thank yous. Appreciate your listening. Ken in Canyon Country, California. Hey, Ken, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how's it going?
Fine. Thanks for listening on TuneIn Radio. What's up?
Thanks. Well, first of all, I wanted to say thanks for coming out to Hollywood last Saturday. I saw you at the KPFK thing. That was great.
Thank you. Yeah, it was a hoot.
Just real quick, I wanted to mention something because I haven't heard anybody talk about this on the news. With all the violence and been going on in the U.S. lately, no one's said anything about the possible correlation between that and hormones and food and the water supply. And yeah. I wanted to get your take on that.
I think anything's possible. The incredible spike that we've seen in neurological variations, anomalies, deviations from the historic norm, whether it's autism spectrum stuff, whether it's hormone mediated or it's neurotoxin mediated, I don't know, but it makes an awful lot of sense to me that that's what's going on. And Ken, Shano tells me that you're the winner of our book today. We're going to send you a copy of Cracking the Code, How to Win Hearts, Change Minds, and Restore America's Original Vision, a book I wrote about political messaging. He's on line one, you could tell Danielle. So she'll pick you up and get your postal address so that we can use stamps.com to send you a copy of that book. And thanks for the call. Howie in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hey, Howie, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Haven't talked to you in a while. The tar sands, I think the tar sands are proof that M.K. Hubbard was correct in peak oil. The amount of fossil fuel that's required is one unit of fossil fuel to produce two units of crude,
right,
where conventional drilling was one unit of fossil fuel to produce 100.
And in some cases more, depending on
yeah,
how close it was to the surface,
I mean,
and how big the reservoir was.
You talk about externalities. I mean, the tar sands has to be the biggest externality on the planet.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's one of the largest carbon pools on the planet, certainly. So, yeah. Yeah, I'm with you, Howie, what you really need to do is check out Greg Palast's, you can see it over at gregpalast.com, his latest reporting on the XL pipeline and its connection to the Koch brothers. It's absolutely fascinating. Howie, thanks a lot for the call. Lawrence in Berkeley, California. Hey, Lawrence, what's up?
Yeah, hi. I have a plan to counteract the Republican gerrymandering.
And that is?
And that is to imitate the Mississippi Freedom Summer of 1964, where thousands of students and progressives went down to Mississippi to register African-American voters. Only this time, the first place to go is to Wisconsin. And to all the various states that voted for Obama, but because of gerrymandering, have state legislatures and House of Representatives that are Republican. And we can undo that by flooding those states with thousands of people who will go and register poor and minority voters. Because there's about 70% of people who are registered and 30% who aren't.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who aren't registered especially the poor ones and the minority ones, are vastly more progressive than the people who are voting and are registered. Yeah.
And young and elderly as well. Lawrence, thanks for the call. Excellent suggestion, and I'm betting, you know, that the Democratic Party's working on it. Coming up next week on the Tom Hartman Program, all the news and information from the weekend, Snowmageddon, what's going on in Congress, a look ahead at the President's State of the Union speech, plus the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week for We the People. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. Tag your it. Get out there. Get active and occupy something. We'll see you Monday.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.